The failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the Century of Lies.
Hello, and welcome to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh, editor of DrugWarFacts.org. The Commission on Narcotic Drugs held a meeting on February 17th. It was the first intersessional meeting of its 63rd session. I was hoping to bring you some audio from that meeting, but unfortunately, the UN office in Vienna hosed the webcast. Hopefully, the CND and UN Vienna will get their stuff together in time for the big meeting that takes place the beginning of March. If and when they do, you'll hear some of that audio on this show. So instead today, we're going to hear some exciting news about harm reduction in the United States. The city of Baltimore is considering whether and how to set up legal supervised consumption facilities. The Baltimore City Council's Health Committee held an informational hearing on February 12th about overdose prevention and harm reduction. We're going to hear some of that audio today. Let's start with the first person to testify at that hearing. Liz Bement is a resident of Baltimore.
Good afternoon, council members. My name is Liz Bement, and I live in Upper Fells Point. I'm here to talk about a tragedy that happened in our family and the reason why I support the overdose prevention sites and other harm reduction measures. My 27-year-old son, Alex Bement, died on May 4th, 2019, of an accidental overdose. The cause of death was fentanyl toxicity. Alex was bright, driven, personable, and kind. He was an all-American athlete. He was very loved by his family and many friends. He was a standout student and a lacrosse player at Loyola Blakefield, and then he went on to study at the University of Pennsylvania, and he played on their Division I lacrosse team. Like many teens, he experimented with drugs, but by his second year at Penn, that experimentation turned into a full-blown addiction to opioids. When we realized what was going on, we sent him to a 28-day rehab facility, Father Martin's Ashley, and followed that up. He spent 6 months in a sober living house. At that time, in our naivete, we thought that was the end of it. He was cured. But with opioid addiction, it's not that simple. It's a chronic relapsing brain disease. It has genetic components. It is complex and extraordinarily hard to overcome. However, over the next 9 years, he did really well, despite several periodic relapses. Here are some of his accomplishments. He lived in Aspen, Colorado, where he coached the Aspen High School lacrosse team. He taught telemark skiing. He was a whitewater rafting guide. He went out to St. Paul, Minnesota. He attended the University of St. Thomas, where he got straight A's while helping the lacrosse team win the championship. That year, he was named Defensive Player of the Year and First Team All-American. Most recently, he lived in Washington, D.C., where he had a terrific job, a loving and accomplished girlfriend, and was a finisher in an Ironman triathlon 8 months before he died. He was happy, thriving, engaged in life. However, last May, he had a relapse after 2.5 years in recovery, and it cost him his life. We are clearly doing things the wrong way. All across the U.S., an outrageous number of people are dying due to fentanyl-laced drugs, and we're just sitting back and watching this epidemic like never before unfold, and we're turning our backs to it. Why? Because of stigma. And while our backs are turned, this disease is killing our families, our neighbors, our friends, students, teachers, and our children. It's killing those all around us, and everyone in this country is just carrying on business as usual. In 2018, 68,000 people died of drug overdoses in the U.S. alone, 186 deaths a day. 186 deaths a day. My son Alex had an illness. His illness did not make him a person to be feared. It made him vulnerable and in need of appropriate support. Addiction can happen in any family, and if it were your family member, you would want them to have the empathy and understanding they deserve with a place that will treat them with compassion and meet them where they are, a place that will offer the best chance for them to stay alive so they can seek recovery, because I can attest to the fact that dead people do not recover.
That was Liz Bement, a resident of Baltimore whose son died from an overdose in 2019. She testified before the Baltimore City Council's Health Committee on February 12th. Now let's hear from Rajani Gadlavaletti. She's a community organizing manager with the Baltimore Harm Reduction Coalition.
So I love the energy and excitement about drop-in centers. I would love to continue to talk about that. In keeping with that line, keeping the excitement going and thinking about how big we can really, like, really thinking and dreaming about what these are, these places, these drop-in centers, and what they can be. So in the organizing work that we do at Baltimore Harm Reduction Coalition, a lot of it, right, we know public education, awareness, this is really important, right, gathering our resources together. So a lot of the work that we do is really thinking about, and my background personally is in doing facilitation around racial justice and racial justice organizing. So I feel like in my 5 minutes, I could talk about a lot of things, but I think it's extremely important to acknowledge and name that we cannot continue to have this conversation about the opioid crisis, and I use quotes very intentionally, cameras, without acknowledging that the racist war on drugs has existed for decades and has been designed to specifically target Black people, period. And when we look at the data that was shared, thankfully, not here now, but previously, from the health department, right, that showed the rates of overdoses, and we see that people 45 to 65, particularly Black men, make up at least half, I believe. So when we look at the war on drugs and how long it has existed, the fact that it's targeted Black men who have either used, didn't use, or sold drugs for a variety of reasons, or just targeted simply by being Black men, and in Baltimore City, and also that we cannot, that's all connected, right? That these overdose rates are so high amongst men in that age group who have been targeted, incarcerated, experiencing drug use, experiencing overdose for decades, right? May have built a tolerance around using drugs at a time when the potency of those drugs was not as high as it is now. Maybe some of those folks were incarcerated for some period of time, right? Come out of incarceration with limited to zero resources, right? And then are using for a variety of reasons, and the supply that they're having access to is so much higher. We have to think about all of these. So I just wanted to bring that up because of the connections our systems and BHSB and the health department were making, and really isolate the fact that we are talking about a lot of people who have been targeted by an overdose crisis, by the war on drugs for so long. And so a lot of the work we do at Baltimore Harm Reduction Coalition and with our harm reduction partners and community partners is talking about this, bringing this up, bringing and illuminating this, and really listening to our community members when we're doing outreach, when we're having dialogues about the rising overdose rates, when we're having conversations about what resources exist for you, what do you trust, right? And when talking to people who are, we've talked to, particularly in the last two summers, we've talked to hundreds, thousands of folks. And I say summer because, you know, a lot of people are outside. So we do these outdoor educational opportunities, having conversations with folks about harm reduction options, right? What do you have now? I could give you naloxone. I could give you Cheetos. I could give you water, right? This is what I can give you right now. And what would you like? Like, let's dream together. And the majority of the people we've talked with in this outreach, in these what I consider kind of corner organizing efforts, which, mind you, are usually done in partnership with churches in high overdose areas, are done literally in the middle of police cars and young men selling or dealing, right? Usually Black men. We are right in the middle there. Doing street outreach, doing tabling with our partners who were highlighted, Be More Power, is a major partner we work with. Be More Power is a network of folks who do overdose response, right? They are people who are identified as peers, people with lived experience, right, from neighborhoods. So we go out, we talk to people, we have something that we call a demonstration overdose prevention site that is not an actual operating space, that an overdose prevention site, which we can get into, but it is a tent, basically, and we talk to people about this is a model that exists, these overdose prevention sites, these different ideas, decriminalization of drugs, these policies that exist around the world. What do you think about it? And we use these opportunities to talk to people out in community about, here's something you can have right now, naloxone, fentanyl testing kits. Also, here are pictures of things that exist that we could have to reduce overdose rates. And every time we have these conversations in communities, one of the first things is like, the people say is, that sounds really white. That sounds really white, overdose prevention sites. Opioid crisis, that phrase sounds really white. And I'm really excited to say that in city council chambers right now because I didn't think I would, but I think it's extremely important to say that. It is so, it's such a foreign concept among people we are working with, we are talking with, who are most at risk of overdose, as we saw from that data, to think about these concepts that exist around the world that have been proven to reduce overdose rates, that have been proven to save lives. People think, well, they won't do that. City Council doesn't care about us. This city doesn't care about us. We've been dying for decades. We've been targeted for decades. We're not going to have, you're not going to give us access to these things. I'm going to continue to go to that row home, that drop-in center, whatever. Those people care about me. I'll keep getting my sandwiches there. I like you, you haven't, you know, you're smiling at me, you're being nice to me, but I don't trust that these programs and these ideas are going to be implemented here. That is what people tell us. People who are most at risk of overdose, people who have lost family and loved ones, who have witnessed overdose, who are actually reviving people's lives with naloxone. These are the people, right, who are saving lives, and they hope that we can have programs that are expanding access to drop-in centers, expanding access, but are worried that their government doesn't trust them. And that is because of the war on drugs. And so I'm hoping that we, in this conversation about the opioid epidemic, as whatever language we want to use, that we talk about what can we actually promise our communities who have been so devastated by the war on drugs for so long. What can we actually take the risk to support? And so I'm pretty sure I got on a whole thing and lost my time and didn't get to actually describe overdose prevention sites. That's where I was headed to, and I'm happy to talk about it. Can I do that? Dope. Okay, so overdose prevention sites are, I'm gonna get really comfortable. They are spaces, there are, they can be in a brick and mortar building on its own. It can be a wing of, like its own facility. It can be a wing of an existing space, like, I don't know, healthcare for the homeless, or a drop-in center, or something else, right? Like a wing, right? A detox center, a treatment center. So they can look like a lot of different things, mobile clinic. There are over 150 of these spaces legally operating around the world, none yet legally operating in the United States. They've existed for about 30 years. First was in Switzerland. They are mostly in Canada, Europe, and Australia. What are they is probably the question, right? So imagine a place like what Harriet was describing, a drop-in center, right? So somebody who is experiencing homelessness, trading or selling sex, using drugs, somebody just who's out and about in public space who says, I'm tired of being outside, I'm going to go inside. So they are welcomed. First station, think of it as three different stations when you're imagining this overdose prevention site. First place is they come to somebody at the front desk and they can get access to syringes, naloxone, condoms, any services, water, right? And then they say, you know what, I really would like to have a safe place for some to use my drugs. Or they say, I could really use someone next to me in case I overdose who can give me naloxone. Or like, cool, here's some supplies. Also, you can go into this second area. So the second area, a bit more private, could be booths or rooms where people would use pre-obtained drugs of any kind under supervision. So there would be staff there. I advocate for people who are considered peers, outreach workers. It could also be nurses, doctors, really anybody. Doesn't need to be anybody with any higher credentials, but somebody who can do overdose response, right? So there's, if I go in, I go to this booth, I prepare, I have hygienic supplies to prepare my drugs, I use my drugs, injections, snorting, sniffing, whatever form I use it, there's somebody there who can make sure I'm okay. right? So let's say I am actively choosing to take fentanyl. I know that it might kill me. I know things could happen, but my body's addicted or whatever, right? Like I need it, I want it. That's what's happening. So I use my drugs, and that person can be there with naloxone, with oxygen, with something to help keep me alive. That is what this is. It's about saving lives. After I've used and I feel okay, that staff member would then take me to a third area, which is like a chill area or somewhere where I can like kind of make sure I feel okay, get access to resources, get coffee, have a conversation with someone who can tell me more information about detox or housing or other things I might need, a hat, whatever. And when I feel better, I can go to work, or I can go take care of my children, or I can go do something, right? Without feeling vulnerable to harassment or overdose or anything out and about. It brings people inside. So I wanted to walk through that. I know that takes a long time, but it's really hard for us to imagine what this would look like. That's what it would be. Of the over 150 that exist around the world, millions of injections have occurred in these places. No one has died of an overdose. Zero deaths have occurred. If that's not enough to prove to us that we need these, I don't know what is. Maryland State Legislature is considering a bill for the fifth year in a row to legally authorize overdose prevention sites in the state of Maryland, with no fiscal note, from what I understand.
That was Rajni Gudlava-Letty, Community Organizing Manager with the Baltimore Harm Reduction Coalition. She was testifying before the Baltimore City Council's Health Committee about overdose prevention, harm reduction, and the need for supervised consumption facilities. We'll have more in a moment. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Baltimore, Maryland is one of the many cities in the United States that are engaged at the highest levels in discussing how to set up legally authorized supervised consumption facilities. People may not think of Charm City as being all that progressive, but it is worth remembering that the former mayor of Baltimore, Kurt Schmoke, kicked off a national debate on drug policy reform back in the 1980s. He didn't actually call for legalization back then. He was quite clear about that. All he said was that we had to start talking about alternatives to the drug war and alternatives to criminalization. Mayor Schmoke gave a keynote address at the Drug Policy Foundation's conference in 1988. I was working for National Normal at the time, so I was lucky enough to attend that conference. Fortunately for you, dear listener, that speech was recorded by C-SPAN. So here's Baltimore's then-Mayor Kurt Schmoke.
Since April, when I first suggested a national debate on our current drug policy, I haven't had too many opportunities, as they say, to preach to the choir. So this is a welcome and although somewhat unfamiliar turn of events for me. However, since April, I have had the pleasure to meet and talk to many of the participants in this conference. And I want to thank Arnold Treback and all of the members of the Drug Policy Foundation for the help and support that you've given both me and the cause of reforming national and international drug policies. Your books, articles, and lectures, and the participation in the workshop that was held in Baltimore were instrumental in helping me to prepare for last month's congressional hearings. Changes in policy, particularly on an issue as emotional as drugs, do not come about without some sort of analytical groundwork that is being done by the participants in this conference. So as one who considers himself certainly not a pioneer, but really as a spokesman for your thoughts and research, I want to congratulate you for the work that you are doing and for giving substance to the debate on decriminalization of drugs. Since I already know that the choir can sing, I didn't bring my standard decriminalization stump speech. Instead, I'd like to talk briefly about the congressional hearings and what needs to be done now that those hearings are over. Let me begin by mentioning, just for a moment, what led me to participate or to call for hearings in the first place. As been stated in the press, part of my interest arose while I was a prosecutor, the state's attorney for Baltimore City. Time and again, I was confronted with tragedies resulted from the random and senseless violence of this black market in drugs. That violence was attributable in large part to the fact that we have chosen to make criminals out of millions of people who have a disease. And as a prosecutor and a citizen, it seemed to me that we were and still are paying too high a price for a policy that is both self-defeating and medically wrong. But crime and what it's doing to our cities was not my only concern for recommending a strategy or a change in the strategy in this so-called war on drugs. I'm also very concerned about the spread of AIDS. I was appointed last January to a committee, the U.S. Conference of Mayors Committee on AIDS. And it was at a small meeting of that committee, along with a nationally known foundation, that I first raised with them the issue of studying the decriminalization of drugs as a part of our strategy to combat AIDS. See, I look at our situation in Baltimore. Intravenous drug users are the second largest but fastest growing risk group for the HIV infection. It's estimated that 15-30% of IV drug abusers in Baltimore City are infected with AIDS. Half of our new AIDS cases are now attributable to the use of dirty IV drug needles. These statistics mean that AIDS is by far the most serious communicable disease in the United States, and our drug policy of zero tolerance is only making matters worse. As an example, at the hearings in September, I listened to Mayor Koch, who has called decriminalization, among other things, quote, a terrible idea, unquote. But if you listen to him, it was very interesting. He told the committee about the proposal in his city for a very limited experimental needle exchange program, a program which by its very nature requires the limited decriminalization of drug paraphernalia, that is, the hypodermic. And what Mayor Koch said at the hearing was that all of his public health advisors said that this would be an effective program and should be implemented. All of the law enforcement advisors counseled against it. He said he was criticized about that program for even this limited attempt to slow the spread of AIDS. And as always, the opponents of decriminalization told Mayor Koch that his program, quote, sent the wrong message, unquote. Well, AIDS has a message of its own. And that message is that thousands of people are going to die, including non-drug-using sex partners and children of addicts, unless we begin to develop a parallel public policy dealing with AIDS and drugs.
That was Kurt Schmoak, then the mayor of Baltimore, Maryland. That was a portion of a speech he gave at the Drug Policy Foundation's second annual International Conference on Drug Policy Reform. It was held in October of 1988. Apologies for the sound quality, but again, that was from 1988. The audio came to us courtesy of C-SPAN. You're listening to Century of Lies. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now let's get back to that hearing before the Baltimore City Council's Health Committee on February 12th. Here's Krista Daring, Executive Director of Sex Workers Outreach Project USA.
I've had a really hard time figuring out what to say today, how much myself to share, how vulnerable to be. This is deeply personal to me. My name is Krista Daring. I was born in Baltimore City. I was raised in the 14th District, and I currently reside in the 3rd. I'm the Executive Director of the Sex Workers Outreach Project USA and a graduate of the Baltimore School for the Arts. I moved to Washington State in 2005 to acquire my bachelor's degree and also intentionally to remove myself from a pattern of addiction and a social circle of overdose. My history of opioid dependency is painfully typical. As a youth athlete, my injury was inevitable, but the overprescription of opioids was not. However, I am not here to cast judgment on the ways in which individuals develop substance use disorders. Substance use disorders are increasingly prevalent in our communities across the country, and the gateway is sometimes overprescription, but as prevalent is a system of injustice and negligence that leaves the vast majorities of our country undertreated for both physical and existential pain. The opioid crisis was only labeled as such when people who look like me became the victims. Substance use disorders and overdose have long ravaged Baltimore, and while it is necessary that we are having this conversation and addressing it now, we owe a great apology to the majority of Baltimore City whose suffering has long been ignored in this crisis. I've been sober from opioids for 15 years. I had the opportunity to leave Baltimore and to change my context. When I moved to the Pacific Northwest, opioids did not have the hold there that they do now. However, within 2 years of moving there, one of my closest friends had overdosed twice on heroin. On his second overdose, he died several weeks before his baby was born. I can barely answer the phone anymore. Every time I see a call come in, especially when I recognize the number, I seize up with anxiety. Since the age of 16, answering the phone requires that I briefly pause and accept mentally that someone I know might be dead. These are preventable calls, but not only that, they are preventable deaths. There are too many stories for me to individually recount, people I loved, people I have only known peripherally, but people I have lost, that we have all lost. These losses in my own history make it a likely trajectory that I would enter harm reduction and first responder medicine. I have intervened in opioid overdoses more times than I can count. I've administered naloxone approximately 6 times. I have not lost a single patient, and I'm just a community member. How many people could overdose prevention sites save? In 2017, Baltimore City saw 761 drug and alcohol-related intoxication deaths. 692 of those were opioid-related. That year, Baltimore had 343 murders. We had more than twice as many opioid deaths as we had murders. In 2011, The Lancet found that fatal overdoses dropped 30% in a single Vancouver, Canada neighborhood served by an overdose prevention site. What if we could reduce our overall murder rate by 30% just by opening a new community center? I'm in favor of more community centers also, in addition to overdose prevention sites. What reasonable argument could there be against that? Overdose prevention sites are part of a mosaic of care, and as someone who provides direct support to those experiencing addiction and other struggles, meeting people where they are at is essential to assisting in a road to recovery. The stigma of addiction and use continues to push folks out of reach of treatment and resources. Baltimore City must commit to investing in patient-centered and patient-led care around substance use disorders and addiction. Overdose prevention sites are one crucial step in that continuum of care. On April 5th, 2019, a friend of many of us in this room, Brittany Fleming, died of an overdose. Her overdose and substance use disorder was compounded by the violence of white supremacy, transphobia, police harassment, and the criminalization of sex workers. We failed Brittany, just as we have failed too many. This is our opportunity to honor those that we have lost and help build a better future for others. I ask the City Council, the State of Maryland, and citizens of Baltimore to join me in supporting overdose prevention sites. For many of our residents, the time to do this has already run out.
That was Krista Daring, Executive Director of the Sex Workers Outreach Project USA, testifying before the Health Committee of the Baltimore City Council on February 12th. And that's all the time we have this week. I want to thank you for joining us. You have been listening to Century of Lies. We're a production of the Drug Truth Network for the Pacifica Foundation Radio Network. On the web at drugtruth.net. The Drug Truth Network has a Facebook page. Please give it a like. Drug War Facts is on Facebook, too. Give its page a like and share it with friends. Remember, knowledge is power. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh, and of course also at Drug Policy Facts. We'll be back in a week with 30 more minutes of news and information about drug policy reform and the failed war on drugs. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long! For the Drug Truth Network, this is Doug McVeigh asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the century of lies. Drug Truth Network programs archived at the James A. Baker III Institute for Public Policy.